That's Béla Bartók's 1940 Rhapsody No. 1 with Joseph Sigeti violin, one of the 50 recordings selected last week by the Library of Congress for the new National Registry of Sound Recordings. Charlie Parker also made the list. That's Charlie Parker's 1945 recording of Coco. Other selections for the registry include turn-of-the-century cylinder recordings of the Metropolitan Opera, the live radio broadcast describing the crash of the Hindenburg, and Kate Smith singing God Bless America. The most recently produced recording is from 1982. Many people consider The Message among the best rap records ever made, and it's probably the first rap record that offered social commentary. It was recorded by Grandmaster Flash and the Furious Five. Melly Mel did the rap.
It's like a jungle sometimes. It makes me wonder how I keep from going under. It's like a jungle sometimes. It makes me wonder how I keep from going under. Broken glass everywhere, people pissing on the stairs, you know they just don't care. I can't take the smell, can't take the noise, got no money to move out, I guess I got no choice. Rats in the front room, roaches in the back, junkies in the alley with the baseball bat. I tried to get away, but I couldn't get far, cause a man with a tow truck repossessed my car. Don't push me, cause I'm close to the edge. I'm trying not to lose my head. It's like a jungle sometimes. It makes me wonder how I keep from going under. Standing on the front stoop, hanging out the window, watching all the cars go by, roaring as the breezes blow. A crazy lady living in.
When Melly Mel recorded The Message, most rap records were party boasts. The Message was a departure from Melly Mel. It was actually his record company that brought him the original lyric of the rap, which was written by Duke Booty. Terry Gross spoke with Melly Mel in 1992.
Our group, like Flash and the Furious Five, we didn't actually want to do The Message because we was used to doing party raps, you know, and like boasting about how good we are and all that. And when the record company brought the record to us to do, we didn't actually want to do it. And I was the only one that, like, I just caved in. I said, listen, if this is the record we're going to do, then I'll just do it, and it's no big thing. But I didn't think that it would be pivotal either way, you know, like on a good or bad end. I just thought it was going to be just another record that we had did.
So did you ever try The Message at parties before you went into the recording studio, or would that have been all wrong?
No, we never tried it. And as a matter of fact, I was shocked because we used to hang out in a club called Disco Fever up in the Bronx, right? And then they took the record, you know, they was testing it, like they tested it down on a record shop on 125th Street, you know, just putting it, you know, just letting it play and people outside, you know, listening to it. And then they tested it in the club where we hung out at, and the people really liked it. And that was coming right behind Planet Rock, which was a big record back then. And when they played The Message in the club and the people liked it, I was kind of shocked because I didn't think that, you know, coming from Planet Rock to, you know, a serious record like The Message, I didn't think that, I thought it would be like a lapse in you know, the level of the crowd, the intensity of the crowd. But it wasn't. So, you know, right then I knew that the record was going to be more than what I thought it was going to be.
Can I ask you how you started rapping?
Well, we started going to parties. They used to be like little, like maybe $1 parties, $2 parties, and they had a DJ called Cool Herc. Yeah, well, it was all DJs, but they rapped. They didn't actually rap in rhythm, but they used to say little phrases, you know, Coke LaRock, Timmy Tim, and Clark Kent. That was the guys' names. And they was the big DJs. They was like the big DJs back then. And we used to go to their parties. And I just started rapping, just trying to emulate them, you know, to be like them, because they was like more or less our heroes back then.
What were some of the kinds of rhymes they were using?
They wouldn't use rhymes. It's like, if you could imagine, it would be like a dark room or a gym. And it's like smoky, because everybody was smoking everything from cigarettes to whatever, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And they'd be playing the music, and then it'd all be echo chamber. So they'd be like, rock, 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 free, free, free. You know, it was like more or less like kind of a psychedelic kind of thing, because everything they said, it was echoes, you know. And this is why they call me the Shoe Machine Shock, y'all. You know, it was like all this echoing. And you walk in there, you'd be like dumbfounded, because it's like you just stepped into another world, you know what I mean? And there's all these dark figures around and smoke and, you know, it was like awesome. You know, for us, it was like a rush, you know, just stepping into these parties.
So what were the early rhymes you were doing?
We was doing like, you know, I'm Melly Mel and I rock so well from the top of the world to the depths of hell. This is my first rhyme. I rock with the best, with the most finesse. I'm taking the top and leaving what's left. Like real simple stuff, you know, just boasting rhymes, you know, nothing real heavy or nothing like that, or nothing real technical, because there was no technique. We were just going by our own thing.
How did you come up with your name, Melly Mel?
Flash gave me that name, because that was my name was just Melvin, so I don't think that would be like a cool name, like,
right.
You know, MC Melvin. So Flash, you know, he started calling me Melly Mel, and it stuck.
Where were the parties held?
In gyms, in not too many halls. We did basically the first halls, but it was like in gyms and like little social club type things. Herc the Hevelo, that was, I guess, was a club. I never was there, but he used to play in the PAL, and that was like a gym. You know, little halls, you know, nothing big or extravagant. But it was like, you know, nice little small dark joints, you know, real comfortable, sweaty, you know.
Was there often trouble at the parties?
Yeah, but like the trouble at the parties was like it was set up like, it was nothing going on in the party itself, right? But all the guys that, like, did stick-ups and stuff like that, they'd be in the bathroom. So when you went to the bathroom, if you didn't know these guys, then they'd rob you. So that it wasn't like how it is now. Like, guys would actually be in the party itself and shoot up the party, or maybe they'd come outside and shoot up the party. If you got shot, you might get shot in the bathroom. You know, that was, like, the only spot that you'd have to be wary of, basically. And then you did have your isolated instances, you know, something happening outside, but it would never happen in the party, so to speak. It'd always be like away from the party.
So would you go to the bathroom? Did you know enough people that
it was
safe for you to go?
I knew everybody, so it was definitely safe. I knew, you know, from, 'cause before I was rapping, I used to be a dancer, so, you know, I just met like all of the stick up guys, all the dope dealing guys. I knew them all. If I didn't know them, I was familiar with them. So, you know, if it's a familiar face, they might let you come and go, you know. And I wasn't no sharp dress. I didn't have no jewelry or nothing like that, or no clean sneakers or, you know, something that, you know, they would want to take. So, you know, I was always safe.
What was the transition like for you from parties to recording studios and concert dates, theaters?
Well, it definitely wasn't hard to do, because even when we was doing like the parties, we seen ourselves like we put ourselves on an entertainment's level, on an entertainer's level. It's like we used to set up, you know, tables and build our own little stage and do our little dance routines. So it wasn't nothing for us to go from, you know, point A to point. As far as rappers go, it's like when Rappers Delight, when Sugar Hill Gang made Rappers Delight, and when we did our first show with them, we blew them out.
What was it like when you started making more money and getting really well known? How did you handle that? I think that's difficult for a lot of people to handle.
Yeah, and I guess it was especially difficult for us back then, because, you know, we started, you know, abusing a lot of things, you know, abusing the money, you know, and messing with drugs and stuff like that, you know, hanging out. You know, we got into that kind of thing. So I guess, And we didn't really have no good management or somebody that we looked up to tell us what to do and what not to do in moderation, or what was cool, or what was going to be what was going to add to our longevity. Because, you know, we was just out there and we was on top, and we just thought that, you know, things was never going to run out, and, you know, eventually they did, because we was very abusive about our career.
So what happened when things ran out?
Well, everybody just, you know, went their own direction, you know. It's like at one point Flash and them had took up a lawsuit against the record company, and, you know, some of the brothers was using drugs. I started using drugs. You know, everything just got real herky-jerky.
Another great record that you made was White Lines, which is a kind of anti-cocaine record. You know,
right.
So White Lines, don't do it.
Right.
So here you were actually doing drugs while you were making the rap?
Right. But see, the whole thing with White Lines is I didn't want to try to make a anti-cocaine song or a song that glorified cocaine. I just wanted to make a song about cocaine, and that was a hit song. Because the music that we used, it wasn't original music. We used it, you know, it was like a club song, Liquid Liquid. That was the name of the song. And, you know, I used to be in the club, and it's like if you ever hear a song and sing your own words to it, in other words. And they were saying something in their record, and every time I would hear it, I would just say, White Lines, you know. And I was like, you know, it could be a good idea to make a song. And that was all a part of the scene anyway, you know, the club scene back then. It was like cocaine then, it wasn't like how it is now. It was more fashionable, you know what I mean? It was fashionable to have it. And I started out not even, you know, I didn't use cocaine. I should just have it because it was fashionable just to have it. You come in the club, you know, everybody know you got blow. Girls know you got coke. And, you know, it was in the euphoria of that, just having it. And people that know you have it, and they treat you better. And that's that all that accumulated to me writing that song, you know, because that's the lifestyle that I was in. I wasn't around nobody that didn't use drugs.
Bass. Vision, dreams of passion, and all the while I think of you. A very strange reaction. The more I see, the more I do. Baby,
tell your body to come along. But white lines blow away.
Blow. Rock it. Blow. Ticket to ride, White Line Highway. Tell all your friends they can go my way. Pay your toll, sell your soul. Pound for pound costs more than gold. The longer you stay, the more you pay. My white lines go a long way, either up your nose or through your vein, with nothing to gain except killing your brain.
How did you come up with the idea of using the higher, higher?
That was just something that came naturally with the song, with the twist and shout thing.
Mm-hmm.
It just came naturally. That was like, you know, me piecing it together in my mind after the verse, and it's higher, baby, higher, you know, and it all fell together. It was something real natural. As a matter of fact, before I even did the song, I even had a dream that went after that I did the song and I heard it and I was in the club and the song was playing. So it's like I heard the song in my head even before we even did the record. So I knew exactly how I wanted the record to sound, so to speak.
If you're just joining us, my guest is rapper Melly Mel. Can I ask you about your family when you were growing up?
Well, our family was more or less, say, not really a dysfunctional family, but it was, you know, it was like my pops drank. And, you know, him and my mother, they couldn't read, so they, you know, used to make us go to school. You know, the important thing was learning how to read. And, you know, it was like that. He drank, and he was abusive. So it's like not the average ghetto family, but, you know, that's nothing new as far as, you know, ghettos go.
So was reading important to you? Did you like to read?
Well, I didn't like to read, but I knew if I did read, or if I could learn how to read, you know, things would be easier, you know.
So when did like words start really meaning something to you?
When I started rapping, because that's when I understood, you know, how you could put the right words together and make, it's almost like making magic, especially when you rhyme. It's like I used to always think back to, you see a witch in front of a cauldron and she's stirring up and she's saying like a rhyme, you know, it always would be a rhyme of all things. And it's like, And to me, my rhymes is like, it's like magic. You know, you could make your own magic, especially if you believe, if you're saying something and you believe in what it is that you're saying, is like magic once you put the right words together.
Did you ever go through a period in your life when things were hard, when you were busted for anything and ended up having to do time?
Oh yeah, when I was very young, though. That was all before I started rapping. Like, you know, just being out in the streets, you know, and running around, you know, robbing people, you know, doing stuff like that, like stupid stuff.
Now, how much time did you spend in prison?
I didn't spend no real time. I spent, like, say, 11 days in juvenile prison, uh-huh. And I spent 5 days in Rikers Island because I lied, right? And I told the cops that I was overage because I didn't want my family. It's like when you get busted in your at a young age and it's late, right? They'll call your house or they'll send the cops to your house and your mother would have to come pick you up. But I didn't want to have to go through that because I knew I'd get a whooping or whatever, right? And I told the cops that I was older, and then they sent me to Rikers Island for 5 days.
Was that a terrifying experience?
Not really. You know, thinking back on it, I guess I was scared then, but, you know, I think I was more scared of getting a whooping if my moms and pops would have came to get me, so.
That's kind of amazing. You'd be more afraid of what your parents were going to do than spending a few days in Rikers Island, which is really one of the worst prisons.
Well, that's what happens when you have a father, you see, because you got to be afraid of your father. And that's how you get respect for law, you know, because somebody's got to be the head. So you definitely was afraid, you know, of what your father would do. That's like the biggest, you know, that's your biggest fear.
So after a few days in prison, did that scare you away from doing anything that would land you back in prison? Or did you feel, well, I can take this. I can manage this.
No, what it was like being in prison and seeing what prison life is so pathetic. It was so pathetic to me that the only time that if I wanted to do a crime, it would have to be like for hundreds of thousands or millions of dollars. Because I mean, when you see guys in prison, and I've got like not really went to prison, but like being arrested and being like in the bullpen area, like a central booking or whatever, and the stuff that guys get busted for that are in prison is like you'll never see like a John Gotti or you know some. You see like a guy, you know, he smacked his wife on the leg or you know somebody that robbed a little corner store. Those are the guys that are in prison, and then they all think they know so much about the law and you know they're taking each other's sneakers. It's so pathetic. It's so pathetic that you. Anybody with a right mind wouldn't even want to be in jail for, you know, no longer than they would have to stay there. Like that two-time loser or the three-time loser, he's a fool because he is nothing in jail except for a bunch of guys that don't even know why they in jail. They too stupid to know that they in jail because they were stupid enough to do something and get caught. And that's all the guys that's in jail. And I didn't think that. I knew that I was too smart to be that stupid, you know, just to do something. And then, you know, oh, man, the policeman or the white man, you know, you did something stupid and you got caught. You were stupid enough to get caught.
I got one last question for you. On your, like, official documents, credit cards if you have them, or driver's license, do you use the name Melly Mel or do you use your birth name?
No, my birth name, Melvin Glover. That's my name.
So how do you feel about that name now?
It's a nice name, you know. I don't really think here nor there about it. You know, some people hear the name Glover, they say, "Are you related to Danny Glover?" I'd be like, my pops was named Danny Glover.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Uh-huh. That's interesting.
Yeah.
All right. Well, listen. Thanks so much for talking with us.
Anytime.
Melly Mel spoke with Terry Gross in 1992. The rap The Message has just been picked as one of the 50 sound recordings worthy of preservation by the Library of Congress.